Slate's coverage of food systems is made possible in part by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. Welcome to Slate's Table to Farm. I'm Laura Anderson, Slate's food and drink editor, and joining me here in New York is Dan Pashman, the host of the Sporkful Food Podcast. Good day, Dan.
Hi, Laura.
I've been trying to vary my greetings
to
Dan.
Yeah, I saw that. That was nice.
Thank you. So each week in this podcast, we start at our trusty table. We choose a particular food, we investigate where it comes from, and finally we cook it and eat it. Today, we are going to talk about dairy.
That's right. This is our Dueling Quesos edition. We're going to be cooking two quesos. One is Laura's Velveeta-based childhood queso growing up in Texas, and another is a queso blanco from my friend Lee and Rachel's new book, which is out this week, called Ultimate Nachos, From Nachos and Guacamole to Salsas and Cocktails.
Dan, are we going to get to play dueling banjos while we're eating the queso?
My hands are going to be occupied eating the queso, but I can tell you that I already have dairy on the brain today because I've been up since 4:30 in the morning because I had, you know, when you have a dream and you get into an argument with someone in your dream and then you wake up and you're in a bad mood?
Oh, yeah.
So that happened to me. I had a dream that I was at Dairy Queen and I was trying to get a Dairy Queen Blizzard with vanilla ice cream and lots of M&Ms and the machine broke. So I just was saying, okay, so just give me vanilla ice cream in a big cup with lots of M&Ms on top, and I'll mix it around myself. And the guy behind the counter didn't understand what I was saying, and he kept saying they couldn't do it. He didn't know what I meant. I had to keep describing it over and over again. They had to get a manager. And I woke up at 4:30 in the morning, and I was so angry about this Dairy Queen debacle in my dream that I couldn't go back to sleep.
This is such a rich metaphor for communication around food.
Yeah.
And I've been thinking a lot about the opacity of dairy, not just literally, but figuratively. I feel like it's not clear to me exactly what's going on, where it's coming from, especially when it comes to products like yogurt and cheese. And I feel like the fact that you were unable to communicate with the guy at Dairy Queen is just a metaphor for how we are really unable to see, you know, where our dairy comes from.
That's exactly why I thought I would share that anecdote.
Your
right
unconscious
now.
Mind is brilliant.
Thank you.
So later in the show, we're going to be speaking to a cheesemonger. But for now, to try to clear up some of the issues around dairy and where it comes from is someone who's written a whole book about it. Kurt Kardashian is a senior writer at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. He's also the author of Milk Money, Cash, Cows, and the Death of the American Dairy Farm. Kirk, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So milk is unique among commodities in that the government plays a critical role in determining how much it costs. So how exactly are milk prices determined?
That's a complicated question. It's been said that there are maybe three people in the entire country that understand how it works properly.
Are you one of them?
I attempt to be.
Cut his mic. We need a new guest.
So I'm just sort of laying the expectations low. You know? So, but basically, you know, the USDA regulates the price that processors have to pay to dairy farmers for their milk.
So a processor is the people who package milk or turn it into maybe yogurt or cheese. Is that
the processor
correct?
is the one that buys it from either the dairy cooperative or the dairy farmer directly, and then pasteurizes it, usually bottles it, and then trucks it to the retail store.
Okay.
So the USDA through this thing called the Federal Milk Marketing Order. The USDA is looking at the quantity of milk being put out on the market, how much is being demanded by processors and by consumers, and then they're setting the price based on that.
Am I correct in assuming that the large corporations who process the milk that they buy from dairy farmers probably put a lot of effort into lobbying the government to keep that price as low as possible?
Yes. Yes. The processors wield an enormous amount of power. And there's only really a couple major processors. Dean Foods is one of them. Hood is another. Between those two, they make up probably 80% of the processors in this country. So I think the dairy farmers usually end up getting the short end of the stick on the milk prices.
And that means that sometimes dairy farmers are spending more to produce milk than they're actually receiving, right? So then what happens then? How does that even work? How do they stay in business?
Yeah, it's a good question. The milk price doesn't take into account really the cost of production. So like the grain bills, the fuel bills, veterinary bills, you know, any of those overhead costs. don't really play into the USDA's Federal Milk Marketing Order price. So what happens is that if there's a little bit too much milk in a certain area, the milk marketing order price is actually less than what it costs the dairy farmer to produce it. And that can only continue for a certain amount of time before farmers have no money left and they have to shut down.
And what was the goal of the Federal Milk Marketing Order when it was first instituted?
Yeah, this is an old law. This actually dates back to the Great Depression. And there was the Secretary of Agriculture back then was named Henry Wallace, and he's sort of a hero of agricultural policy, and he had the idea to sort of federally regulate the milk prices to prevent wild volatility in the market, to give more stability to both price and supply. But it hasn't really changed much since then. So I think most people would agree that it's very antiquated and doesn't really respond to the economy of today.
But it was done to help farmers or to help consumers or to help processors or all of the above?
Mostly to help farmers and consumers.
So earlier in the series, we spoke to a former AP agribusiness reporter who told us about the life cycle of cattle that are raised to be slaughtered for beef. How does the life of a dairy cow differ from the life of a heifer or a steer?
I don't know how long heifers and steers live in the beef industry, but the typical lifespan of a modern Holstein that is bred to make milk is about 3 to 5 years, and the natural lifespan of a cow is 20 years plus. So these cows are being born either in a calving operation that's specifically designed to raise calves to sell to dairy farms, or they're being born on dairy farms themselves. And then as soon as they can get pregnant and lactate, they are put into the production cycle and they are milked and will typically, you know, be artificially inseminated, you know, multiple times during their lifespan. And on a traditional factory dairy farm, they'll live 3 to 4 years and then be sold for slaughter.
Presumably, since they've been bred to produce milk, their meat is not the same quality as what you would get from a cow that was bred to produce meat. So what happens to their bodies then?
They become beef, or they go into dog food, or they go into ground beef.
And one of the things Laura and I were both sort of wondering is, for a cow, is it unpleasant to continue to produce milk and be milked?
That's a good question, and we don't really know what cows like and what they don't like. I've in researching my book, I talked to numerous veterinarians, and depending on sort of their own philosophy, they can either fall on the side of PETA and sort of be animal rights activists, or they can be a little bit more pragmatic and say, you know, dairy cows have a basic level of intelligence. They can feel pain. They can experience happiness and comfort. So, you know, any sort of position that they're in that makes them feel pain will cause suffering. And if they are milked in a way that is reasonable, you know, for their you know, physiology, then that's sort of what they expect, and they're okay with that.
How do dairy farmers get their cows to produce as much milk as possible?
That is an interesting story of technological innovation over the past 100 plus years in the dairy industry that has allowed dairy farmers to produce more and more milk from fewer and fewer cows. And it basically falls under four categories: breeding, feeding, milking, and cow comfort.
What is cow comfort? Sounds great.
Yeah, I know, right? Cow comfort, farmers have realized that happy, comfortable cows make more milk than uncomfortable cows. So cow comfort means keeping them cool, mattresses to have where they can lie down in their stall so they're not on concrete or in mud. And, you know, just having lots of fresh water and things that they like.
It's interesting because so much of this, in general, so much of these changes in the industry, industrialization of our food system comes down to cost-benefit analysis. and it's just about how much food can we get out of these animals for how little money. And this is one of the few instances where treating the animal better is economically beneficial.
That's true, yeah, which is nice. And I think the more conscientious farmers focus more on cow comfort than they do on sort of the production side.
I wanted to ask you about organic milk. Mm-hmm. I make a point when I go to the grocery store of buying organic milk because it feels like it's probably at least slightly better than the conventional milk that's available. I see mostly two major brands, Horizon and Organic Valley.
Yeah, the picture on the carton looks very
charming. The picture on the carton, I always go with Organic Valley because the picture on the carton is very convincing to me.
Yeah.
But am I just being duped? Is organic milk actually any better in any significant way than conventional milk?
Well, it depends on your definition of better, I guess. You know, from a perspective of antibiotics and pesticides and herbicides and artificial chemicals being introduced into the supply chain of a dairy farm, and if you don't like those things, then organic milk is better, you know. But if you're thinking about sustainability, then organic milk is not necessarily better because there's really nothing in the organic regulations saying that an organic dairy has to balance its inputs of grain with its outputs of manure. You know, organic dairies can get their organic grain from China, which a lot of them were getting this fall after the drought in the Midwest caused a supply problem. So if you have a small conventional farm that is operating in harmony with its environment, you know, I think that could be producing a higher quality product than an organic farm. And then there's the issue of ultra-high temperature pasteurization, which is the norm for organic milk. And what that does is that not only does it kill the bacteria, it also kills the beneficial enzymes protease and lipase. And it also reduces the amount of omega-3s in the milk. So it ends up being sort of a less nutritional product. But they do it because it gives the milk a longer shelf life, which makes it easier to distribute over long distances and to keep in the store longer.
Do you have any dairy guilty pleasures?
Guilty pleasure? I don't know if it's guilty, but the thing I love to do is make my own yogurt. Mm. And, you know, there's nothing better than getting fresh gallon of or half gallon of whole milk, you know, in the glass bottle that I can get from my local dairy and making my own yogurt and having it like in the morning. You know, it's just it's great. I think it tastes a lot better than what you can buy in the store.
That sounds like the least guilty thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, that was the worst guilty pleasure I've ever heard of.
I'm Kurt. Sorry.
No, it's
pathetic.
Good. I'm glad that you're one of our final guests on this show because we've been talking to people about the hypocrisy in our diets, and it sounds like you are actually not very hypocritical at all. You
Kirk feels so guilty for his homemade yogurt.
Maybe I'll be as consistent in our diets as Kirk is.
Yeah.
Kirk, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was fun.
Kirk Kardashian is the author of Milk Money, Cash, Cows, and the Death of the American Dairy Farm. Dan, one of the things we didn't get a chance to talk about with Kirk very much was raw milk. And I know that you have reported a story on that for NPR.
Yeah, I did a story a while back. It was a lot of fun. Went up to a farm in upstate New York where they sell raw milk, learned a lot about the process, also talked to some scientists and got their perspective. And so we'll link to that story at the show page, slate.com/tabletofarm, for people who want to hear and see a little more about raw milk.
Great. One place where you see the label raw milk a lot is in cheese. And since we're making queso today, we thought that we should talk to someone who can talk to us a little bit about how cheese is made and what kind of cheese we should be using when we're making queso, other than Velveeta. So joining us now in New York is Elizabeth Chubbuck. She is a cheesemonger and the associate director of wholesale at Murray's Cheese. Elizabeth, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I guess my first question is a really basic question, which is what exactly is cheese? What is the technical definition of it and how is it made at its most basic?
So there's a lot of different things we like to say about cheese and what it is. The controlled spoilage of milk, I think, is the explanation that I use most frequently because I think it gives people a very clear idea of coagulation, right? We've all left milk uncontrolled in our refrigerator and it has spoiled and separated into curds and whey or liquid and solid. But when you're making cheese, you're basically manipulating the protein structures in milk to consolidate fats or coagulate fats and proteins and separate the solid matter from the liquid. And that is cheese in a nutshell.
And once that happens, you have attained cheese.
Cheese has been attained. Okay.
But then what's the difference between cheese and yogurt? Because yogurt is also controlled spoilage, right?
So yeah, but yogurt is more of an acidification and cultured product, whereas when you're making cheese, you're also usually adding some sort of an enzyme, a rennet, a form of coagulant that has a different basically when you proteins in milk look like Koosh balls, and on the end of each little Koosh strand is a negatively charged ion, right? And they press themselves away from each other in milk, thus suspending big round molecules of fat in water. So when you acidify milk, you just break the center of that thing, it realigns, it forms a loose net, you get a sort of loose, watery yogurt curd. When you add that enzyme, you coagulate it, it selectively depolarizes the ends of those protein strands, and it creates a tighter net.
Wow.
And did you have a background in like physics or chemistry before you got into this?
No, but I love every bit of it.
That was great. That's the most technical and probably clearest definition that we've gotten over the course of this podcast.
That was impressive.
It was definitely the most like molecular level. Like I don't think we've ever actually gotten to the molecular level before today.
That's right. That was very exciting.
Yeah. So then obviously there are so many different kinds of textures of cheese. What accounts for those different textures given that at the base, everything is just sort of coagulated milk?
It's basically a moisture management more so than anything else. So, right, if you start with your milk, it's a liquid. You transform it into a solid by adding acid and some sort of enzyme that manipulates the structure. And then you get like that basic curd there. It looks like a piece of jello made out of milk. And you then need to cut that curd into smaller and smaller pieces. When you do that, water that is trapped in those bonds gets released and you end up with your curds floating in whey, right? Like the Little Miss Muffet's out on a tuffet, et cetera. So the whey is
drained. How often? Like how many times per week do you mention Little Miss Muffet?
She's like at least a weekly reference in my world. Little Miss and I have a long relationship. But so that curd is the basic building block for all the different styles of cheese that you have in the market. And the way it's manipulated, whether you cut it smaller, whether you cook it and add heat to it, is going to determine how much moisture is in the curd. And then eventually those pieces of curd are going to be scooped up into a basket. The whey will drain out of the sides of the basket, and that will be your basic, that's your fresh cheese. So at that point, you can put weight on top of it to press the curds tighter together, expel more moisture, get a drier, firmer cheese, or you can cut the curds into large, wet, heavy pieces of milk jello and just scoop those up into a basket, let them drain minimally, and have a softer, more luscious, oozing cheese texture.
Elizabeth, there's a super old school Italian place in Brooklyn where I get fresh mozzarella, and they make it in the back room and they pour it straight out of the pot into this big room temperature vat. They don't chill it. And it's amazing. And I used to also get pretty good mozzarella at this place called Fairway, a supermarket chain here in New York. Until one day I went to pick up their fresh mozzarella, picked up a ball of it from the counter, and it was cold and hard. And I said to the guy behind the counter, what gives? And he said, well, the Board of Health came by and they told us we have to start chilling the mozzarella. And it has never been as good since they started doing that. So I have a two-part question for you. Part one, why is mozzarella and most cheese better at room temperature? And part two, what's your take on these kinds of Board of Health regulations?
A cheese that's cold is all sort of tense and has its flavors all locked up. As it comes to room temperature, it starts to soften, it starts to relax. If it's soft, it might bulge on one side, it might ooze across the table. And that's when the aromatics start to open up and you really start to smell it. So we like to, we would recommend taking a cheese out of the refrigerator for at least an hour before service. 2 hours if you can, at your own house parties.
But what is it about making, about the making, because once that mozzarella gets refrigerated, even if you bring it back to room temperature, it's better than it was when it was cold, but it's still not as good as it was before it got refrigerated.
It's the same with chocolate chip cookies.
That's true, I guess. It's just better. Yeah. And then what about Board of Health regulations as a general matter? I mean, there are a lot of European cheeses that can't be brought into the U.S. because they're worried about them not being cooked at the right temperature or other issues like that. So I want your take, Elizabeth. Is this sort of overprotective nanny state that's stopping us from eating better cheeses, or are most of these rules made with good reason?
I think that the rules are definitely made with good reason. The cheeses coming out of Europe, for the most part, are produced in relatively large quantities, and it's absolutely vital that proper sanitation practices are in place for every step of the cheesemaking process.
But would you rather live a longer life eating substandard cheese or a shorter life eating delicious cheese?
I would rather live long enough to eat delicious cheese.
Touche.
So let's say I have like a half a pound brick of cheddar. How much whey was created in the process of making that?
Well, the basic formula is that 10 pounds of milk will yield 1 pound of cheese.
So I never knew that exact figure, but I guess I always knew that it takes a lot of milk to make cheese. And for that reason, I think of cheese as being this kind of ethically problematic food, because I know that dairy is the way that most dairy is produced is pretty bad for the environment, that a lot of cows are not treated that well when they're being milked. And so, like, eating this super concentrated form of milk seems like it's probably not the best thing I could be doing with my diet. Do you have anything to say to make me feel better about the amount of cheese that I can consume? Is there an ethical defense of cheese to be made?
Well, absolutely there is. But it does depend on what type of cheese you are consuming. So I would actually like to say that there is, in fact, an ethical argument for the production of cheese, when particularly we're talking about small-scale artisan cheesemakers. Cheesemaking is a way for farmers to add value to their milk. So they are basically, you know, looking at an economic model that is not sustainable unless they're finding some way to add value to their milk. When you make cheese, you can actually get a higher price per pound for your milk. So not only are we, by consuming and purchasing artisan domestic cheeses, we're supporting the livelihood of these farmers, who in turn are able to keep their land and prevent parking lots, large supermarkets and things from taking over.
But do you feel like when you talk about mass-produced cheese, where you need massive numbers of cows to be in one place churning out massive quantities of milk, would you group that kind of cheese more in the ethically problematic category that Laura's talking about?
Ethically problematic, yeah, absolutely. Delicious. Definitely.
Hey, don't worry, Elizabeth. We're about to eat Velveeta-based queso over here, compliments of Laura the vegetarian. So one of the recurring themes of our series has been the fact that we're kind of all hypocrites in one way or another when it comes to what we eat. So don't feel bad. You're in a safe place here.
I'm an equal opportunity cheese lover.
So then say that you live in a place where you don't have a wonderful cheese shop like Murray's nearby, and you buy your cheese at the supermarket. What should you be looking for?
I would look for local and cooperatively produced cheeses. So maybe it's not organic, but maybe it comes from a medium-sized artisan dairy who is sourcing their milk from 10 to 15 small local family farms, in which case you're dealing with smaller herds of cows, and also you can know that the cheese you buy goes to support directly the lifestyle of these farmers.
We're going to be making queso for this episode. Do you have any advice for us when you're buying cheese for the express purpose of melting it? What should you look for? And also then when you are melting it, what kind of techniques should you be employing?
So for the melting, cheeses tend to be the Alpine style. So Comté, Fontina, Gruyère, Raclette. The best way to determine whether or not it melts is to take a small piece between your thumb and forefinger and smash it, sort of smush it together and spread it out a little bit between those two fingers. If it crumbles and falls apart in little grains, it's not going to melt with elasticity. But if when you smush it between those fingers, it moves into what resembles almost a pie crust or some sort of a dough, that's an indication to you that it will melt with elasticity.
So when I smash Velveeta between my fingers, it's kind of like Play-Doh. What did they do to Velveeta to make it like that?
A lot of food additives.
You don't want to know, Lara.
Yeah. No, you're probably right.
Withdraw
about that
question. Strike it from the record.
Things your body cannot digest. Yeah.
Elizabeth, one more question for you. You work at Murray's, one of the famed cheese shops of New York City. But what is one of your cheese guilty pleasures?
Well, I will tell you that I was in the sticks of Pennsylvania yesterday afternoon, and we stopped at a roadside bar that was built out of an aluminum barn, and I ordered the Nacho Supreme, which came dripping with nacho cheese sauce. I mean, yellow, thick, and it was so delicious. But there's also a big discussion on Facebook amongst our cheesemongering friends right now about macaroni and cheese in a box, and the majority of us are all coming clean about the fact that we keep it in our pantry.
Wow. That's a story right there. Someone's going to blow the lid off
that. Scandal. Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, guys.
Elizabeth Chubbuck is a cheesemonger and the associate director of wholesale at Murray's Cheese in New York. What do you think?
Velveeta's got a lot more kick.
Yeah. So I asked you before we started recording if you could tell the difference, and we're going to post a picture on our show page. They're very, very different in appearance. The Velveeta is a beautiful, bright, shiny orange color. And the queso blanco from scratch is, well, it's white.
It's blanco.
It's blanco. It has little bits of poblano pepper that you can see in there. I was surprised the recipe calls for not really cooking the poblanos very much, but I like it. Like, you get a little bit of crunch because the poblanos are mostly raw. Whereas the Velveeta one is extremely processed. For people who aren't familiar with this kind of queso, you buy a pound of Velveeta. It comes in pounds. You buy a pound of Velveeta. You buy a can of Rotel, which is just a mixture of diced tomatoes and green chilies.
And that's spelled R-O-T-E-L. I Googled it when you were talking about it.
I believe there's a star in between the row and the tell.
Oh, okay.
I believe it's spelled R-O-star-T-E-L.
Oh. The star is silent?
The star is silent. At least there's a dash in there. But yeah. It's a brand of tomatoes with chilies. So you just put the Velveeta, you chop up the Velveeta, you put it in a saucepan, you add the can of Rotel. Don't drain the Rotel. That's amateur mistake. It's actually the only possible mistake you can make. And then you melt it, and the Velveeta melts into an amazing, creamy, emulsified, additive-rich mixture.
Well, they both have their place, Lara. But I got to say, having not grown up with the Velveeta,
mm-hmm.
not having that special attachment,
mm-hmm.
I would vote for the queso blanco.
Interesting. Why do you like it better?
I think you made the point that the poblanos are crunchy. I like that. But it's really just – I mean, I happen to like Munster cheese, which is an ingredient in this queso. And while there are certainly plenty of artificial foods that I have no problem with, I really, really have sort of a disdain for processed cheese.
I don't know. It tastes like childhood to me.
I wish we had a control. I wish there was a parallel Laura Anderson who had been raised on this queso blanco so we could determine how much of it is objective taste sensation, how much of it is just sort of warm comfort food from childhood, sense memory.
I want to be that Laura Anderson who was raised with this, you know, classy queso.
Yeah. Well, we will post the recipes to both of these quesos on our website, slate.com/tabletofarm. And that queso blanco recipe came from my friend Lee and Rachel's new cookbook. They're the people behind Nachos New York, Lara. And that book is called Ultimate Nachos, From Nachos and Guacamole to Salsas and Cocktails. It comes out this week. And in fact, we should mention very briefly, they're also the people behind Guactacular 2013, May 5th at the Bell House in Brooklyn, where you will be making guacamole, competing in the guacamole competition.
That's right. My colleague Catherine Goldstein and I will be appearing at Guactacular, making Catherine's recipe for guacamole, which she published in Slate about a year ago.
That's right. And I'll be doing my other podcast, The Sporkful, live on stage for the first time ever at Guactacular 2013. So I'm really excited about that.
So for those of you who are going to miss the podcast after this episode, which is the final one that we have planned for now, and if you live in New York, you should come to the Bell House on May 5th.
That's right.
So, Dan, before we say goodbye for now, I'm curious to hear if, having learned a lot about where our food comes from over the past several weeks, if you're going to make any changes in the way that you purchase food and the way that you eat.
I don't think it'll change the way that I purchase fruits and vegetables. But in terms of meat and the way animals are treated, it's the kind of thing that a few years ago when I read Omnivore's Dilemma, I was very fired up about being more careful about where my meat comes from. And it was something that I put a lot of focus on. And that's always been the case. I didn't give up on it. But I would say that I sort of slowly got more lax over time without really realizing it and ate more and more meat from questionable sources. And so I've sort of kind of renewed my resolve to be a little more thoughtful and careful about where meat that I eat comes from. But what about you?
You know, I'm the same. I feel like I'm not going to probably change the way that I get my fruits and vegetables. But I think that having talked to so many people who can shed light on where animal products come from, I realize more than ever that I really do think that vegans are the only people out there who have a consistent philosophy and whose habits reflect that philosophy. You know, I feel pretty complacent as a vegetarian a lot of the time because I'm like, oh, I don't eat meat. That means that, you know, I can eat cheese and eggs and not really worry about it. But the truth is, I don't need to be eating dairy and eggs every day.
But I don't think folks should leave this series feeling especially guilty or unhappy. I think that one thing we've learned in this series is that there are more and more alternatives. So I think there's definitely a positive message there. I do want to ask you, though, Laura, as you say here that you're going to cut back on dairy consumption, who's going to finish these two giant bowls of queso?
Well, these bowls of queso are here. It would be wasteful to throw them away.
That's true. You're really – I think that any
ethicist – I'm going to start next week. I'm going to start having more vegan days next week. That does it for us this week. Thanks so much, Dan.
Thank you, Laura.
Dan's food podcast is called The Sporkful. You can search for it on iTunes or find it at sporkful.com. You can also get our two recipes for queso on our show page at slate.com/tabletofarm. And thanks so much to everyone who has been tuning in these past several weeks. It's been a real pleasure to do this series and to share it with you.
Laura, can you pass a napkin, please? I'm going to need some napkins.
Is that the end? Is that the end of our series?
Yeah, I think so. That's all I got.